to Behind the Wheel, Under the Hood, and Beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Boland.
Ben, we've got a topic today that I'm so excited to talk about. This is a really, really cool one.
This is a heart-stopping topic, and we're going to go ahead and let you guys know that we're going to do something a little bit multimedia, aren't we, Scott?
Yeah, you may be in for a treat in this episode, because we may try to get some audio clips in here that'll add a little bit of excitement to what we do. And as always, you know, we're going to encourage you to go to maybe to our blog. I don't know where we're going to post these, but we're going to post the videos as well that go along with all of these moments that we're going to talk about today, because there's some fantastically exciting moments that that happen in motorsports, as you know. And we've got just a few of them here. I mean, there could be literally thousands of these.
Thousands, yeah.
But we've kind of gathered, about 8 or 9 of these things, maybe, I think, that we find particularly exciting, particularly interesting, and they all revolve around the final lap of a race.
We talked about this before we went on air, right, Scott? We didn't want to call it the best last laps.
Yeah, that's right. It's just exciting.
Things that we really enjoy, and we hope that you guys will enjoy them too. Now, that being said, these are just auto races. These are no, they're no motorcycle races. There are no famous last yacht laps or anything.
No, nothing like that in this one. It's just auto racing. And we've got, a little bit of, not everything. We've got IndyCar, we've got NASCAR, we've got a little bit of Formula One in there.
Yeah, Spanish Grand Prix.
Yeah, I think that's about it, really. I mean, just those three series, really. But, I'll tell you, that's more than enough to talk about right now. I know that there's, like I said, there's a million of these out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta remember, it's not just a moment in a race that happens, because there's, again, another million moments like that.
Yes.
These are focused on strictly the last lap. Like, maybe what happened right up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
But the last lap is really critical in the way the whole race ended up. And before we get started, I do have to make one correction to something that we talked about not long ago.
Okay.
We had a story on the Corvair, if you recall.
Yes, sir.
And that's actually getting quite a bit of response, a lot of good response,
mm-hmm.
a lot of positive response. But the person that suggested this originally, I think his name is Joel.
Rushworth?
Rushworth, that's right.
Yeah.
He wrote back to us on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And, first of all, he said, you know, I was kind of watching this as it happened. He said, well, I'm listening to the episode. Great job, you know. And then there's another comment like, not bad, but I've got one little comment here. So,
yeah.
I figured I'd just, go ahead and mention this and just get it out there that there was a correction, from Joel.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks, Joel, for catching this. I appreciate it. In that episode, we mentioned a collapsible steering column versus we mentioned a telescoping steering column. That's what we said. And what we were talking about, or what we meant to describe, was a collapsible steering column. And that's what we meant. Now, I don't know how that's going to play into, I haven't even listened back to this, but, because we just got this correction, but, I'm not sure how this plays into our research on this, because I mentioned that the Futura, I think, was it? The Ford Futura?
Yes.
Had the collapsible I said the collapsible steering column. Possibly that one had a telescoping steering column. I'm just not sure. I'm sorry. It was the Ford Thunderbird that we mentioned.
Mm-hmm. It was the Thunderbird.
55 Thunderbird.
Right.
And, you know, I think we mentioned the Cadillacs later on. Now, it's not the same thing. Now, a telescoping column, as Joel points out, is one that can move forward and backward. And that's for driver comfort.
Right.
I mean, how far out you have to stick your hand to grab the wheel.
Yeah, they're adjustable by the driver, but they still, as Joel said, lock and become rigid.
Yeah, that's the critical point there, is they become rigid, and it just becomes, again, one solid steering column all the way up to the steering box up in the front. Now, the collapsible is more for safety, and, I want to say something like Ford, I want to say.
Okay.
I wish I had a better note on this here, but I think that early on someone had a collapsible steering wheel a splined wheel that was able to drop back. That's not the same thing. Now, a completely collapsible column, that's completely different. That's one where it has a joint in the middle that allows it to break free, and it doesn't become one, like a spear almost, really, that can come into the cabin. So collapsible is for safety. And by 1968, I think is what is the way Joel put it. And I did look this up. 1968 is when all cars in the United States, including the Corvair, had to be equipped with them. That was the federal mandate. So,
right. And you said, and as you said, if people check out our Facebook page, Car Stuff HSW, they can see that conversation. Now, Scott, buddy, I'm not going to leave you out in the cold here on this because I had a correction for something that I said from a listener named John who wrote to us with an email. And I wanted to address this on air because I think you made a really great point. John mentions, and he did like this podcast, he said, don't forget that the tire pressures recommended were for bias ply tires. Bias ply tires are bad handling to begin with. A Corvair on radials will handle very well.
So newer tire technology.
Right. And that's a good point because when I had those original stats for the tire pressure, I did not mention the kind of tire, and that needed to be clarified. So I wanted to say thank you to John and thank you to Joel. And now that we have clarified some of that stuff.
Yeah, fair enough.
Now,
we do need to kind of lead into this a little bit.
Right, some context for our last laps.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I want to say that, you know, we said that it's the last lap. It's not a moment in the race or whatever. We've already covered all that.
Right.
I would say that a lot of these are going to be controversial in some way because there's something that happens in that last lap that someone says, oh, he's blocking and that's why this happened, this wreck happened, or
oh yeah,
you know, there's gonna be a lot of that. There's always, yeah, you're right, two sides to every story. So think to yourself as you listen to these or as you watch these on your own,
mm-hmm.
Was it dangerous? Was it foolish? I mean, was it like it's often called a heroic move, or is it called irresponsible? It
right.
kind of depends on the take you know, the way you see it, really.
And a lot of times it depends on which racer you're a bigger fan of. Let's be honest. People do have some bias here.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And I mean, it's always and what we're looking at is we're looking at all or nothing finishes. I mean, they're going to leave everything out on the track because at this point, you know, they've raced the full 499 and a half miles. And this is the last half mile of the 500 race.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or similar. And, you know, at this point, it's all or nothing. And the announcers in these things, that's one thing that we're going to have a tough time ourselves conveying. Hopefully when the listeners, listen to this on their own or watch these on their own,
yeah.
they'll get the point that, you know, the announcers make such a dramatic difference in this. If you were to just watch the clip alone,
On mute,
not nearly as exciting. Now, a lot of these guys, they just lose their minds at this point because, you know, they're as caught up into the whole thing as everybody else. I mean, there's a lot of adrenaline, there's excitement.
Sure.
There's just so much going on the track at one time that they can't get it all out at once. You know, people are watching different points. A great announcer truly makes the race, I think, in my opinion. That's just something that you can't get around. And there's always, you know, a lot of drama leading up to the last lap. You know, it's like there's always a moment like now, especially watching IndyCar.
Yeah.
Is there enough fuel? There's a huge fuel strategy going on at the end of the race.
And you'll hear announcers talk about that too, especially in a couple of these that we mentioned, because when you get to the point of the last lap and your fuel calculation is telling you that you might be at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, you may not have enough for, you may have enough for, you know, the 199 and a half of the 200 laps.
Oh, what is that like?
That really does happen. And it happens often. And they have different gearings, as we'll find out, that they can select to decide, you know, if they're going to be in fuel economy mode or if like full race mode. And it makes a huge difference at the end of the race. And I can't tell you, Ben, how many times I've seen an IndyCar coasting on the last lap as, you know, positions 2, 3, 4 past the leader.
Yeah.
The former leader, I should say.
Ooh, it's got to be a certain sort of bitterness.
It happens. I mean, and people get desperate. There's sometimes crashes. It's always emotional in some way.
So let's dive in, huh?
Yeah, let's just jump right in, and I'll do my best to, you know, convey some of the excitement of this. But what we're going to do is just set up the what's going on, really.
Yeah.
So I think the first one is you have to look at the 1996 kart series at Laguna Seca, and this one is just simply called the Pass.
Yes, I call it the infamous Pass. Now, of course, we're going to be moving around in time here, so 1996 is not going to be the earliest thing we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But in this pass, Alex Zanardi passes the racer Brian Herta.
Yeah, but not just any pass.
No.
This is a last lap pass in the, of course, you know, Laguna Seca, that's a difficult track to pass on anyways. It's an 11-turn track that has, it's like 2.25 miles long, I think. Extremely difficult to pass in a lot of different, there's just a few places where you can easily. But, of all places for him to choose to pass, now he chooses to pass in the corkscrew turn.
Which is one of the most dangerous parts of the track when you're just driving.
Absolutely. Now, no one expected this. You know, of course, there's a few different, Zanardi had the pole position for the day.
Yes.
And this is his rookie year, by the way, 1996. So Alex Zanardi, who, you know, there's a lot going on with his racing career. You need to look into that. But Paul Page is an announcer. There's a lot, and which lends to this huge, okay. First sidebar of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Get this. When I lived in Indianapolis, and I've mentioned this many times, I've lived there, and that's why I'm so infatuated with the Indy 500, right?
Uh-huh.
Paul Page, the announcer of the Indy 500, and you recognize his voice instantly if you ever watch any race at all.
Yeah.
His brother was my gym teacher. And,
Really?
Yeah, it was really strange. It's just a weird connection. And, when I was in elementary school, his brother was my gym teacher. Right there in Indianapolis.
Did you get any hookups?
I did not. You know, and I was really young at the time. My dad worked for a network that was covering the Indy 500, and he would, you know, direct the practice sessions and, you know, the time trials and things like that.
Oh, wow.
So we got to meet Paul also. But, you know, to his brother, and I wish I could remember his name now. I just don't remember his brother's name. But it was an interesting connection, I thought.
So
okay.
Here's something interesting about this.
Sure.
I want to point out that Zanardi, had he done this more recently, would have been penalized, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Now, he went 2 wheels off the track at some point.
Uh-huh.
For 4 wheels to go off the track, I think that would have disqualified him because he gained a position in doing so.
Mm-hmm.
But the pass, I mean, you just absolutely have to see it in order to even believe it. Now, what makes this one so exciting for me, not only where it happened and how it happened, you know,
and the fact that for a minute, it looks like he's not going to break.
No, it sure doesn't. It looks like he's going to spear right into the side of Herta. But in fact, he makes it a very, very skilled move. I'll tell you that. Now,
again,
this is one. Is it heroic? Was it stupid?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'll leave that up to you because there's a lot of debate either way. I think it was a pretty darn bold move. I mean, it was really, really brave of him to do this, I guess.
I mean, it's precision driving.
It really is, and lots of control. But what's really cool is that the announcers, they're just kind of going on. Now, this is the last lap, and it's getting close to the end because this is like turn 8 and 8A is what the corkscrew is considered out of 11, I believe. And they're not really expecting anything to happen at this point. So when you're watching the clip as they're talking, you know, they're like, it's kind of like the end of the race wrap up almost. Like, oh, this has been a great, great race. And, you know, who's going, you know, we've seen a lot of changes, et cetera. And then it's almost like no one can believe it. They're like, oh, look at this, you know, and they get real excited. And it's really, really cool. It's just and at that point, you know, it's like you get the adrenaline rush in your body and like the hair on your arm stand up, you know.
Well, let's play a little clip of it real quick, just so our listeners can get the sense of what's happening here.
So now you get the feel for some of the excitement of around that moment, right? Mm-hmm. And normally it's not seen as a passing opportunity. So, you know, that's what makes this one so unusual. It's just such a bold and daring place to make this move. And by the way, Jimmy Vassar, who finished fourth on that day, he ended up winning the Drivers' Championship for that year, for 1996. But, you know, it was completely lost in the news. You know, like the big news was this pass.
Oh, yeah, it was sort of the page 3 headline then because of the pass.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, those sorts of passes are attempted far more often than they are successfully completed. That's another thing about this, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's often, you know, the way it ends up the other way and that both cars end up in a pile of, you know, rubble off on the side of the track.
Unfortunately.
And position number 3 ends up taking the victory.
Now, we said we're going to jump around in time a little bit. Where do you want to go next, Scott?
How about a race where that exactly happened? because, you know, this is one that, I think we've mentioned this one on our Facebook page.
Yeah, we have.
I know that, when this year's Daytona 500 is coming up, I pointed it out as one of my favorite moments in, well, in NASCAR racing history, really. This is the infamous fist fight at the 1979 Daytona 500.
Yep. This is the moment where, Cale Yarborough and Donnie Allison, depending on who tells you the story, we're just going to tell you the facts, okay? First, I think, just to be fair, Scott, we should just say the objective facts.
Sure.
Both of these vehicles end up wiped on the infield.
That's right.
And that is only the beginning of their story.
Yeah, that's right. And there's actually three members involved in this race.
Oh, you're right.
If you want to get down to it. Bobby Allison, who is Donnie Allison's brother, also gets into this fight. Now, I think he is the one who was initially struck with Cale's helmet when Cale threw his helmet.
Right. And let's keep in mind, this is the final lap. This is not just the final lap. This is turn three of the final lap.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, it's a really difficult race, you know, throughout the whole day. Now, this is 1979. Mm-hmm. I just want to point out again, and as I did in Facebook a long time ago, that this was the first 500-mile race broadcast in its entirety live on television. So it's a big deal for NASCAR. This is a huge event. Now, to get a lot of people watching, you know, they were, you know, hoping to get a lot of people watching, mm-hmm. I should say. And a lot of people think that this fight at the end of the race made all the difference in the world. They think it instantly made a lot of NASCAR fans.
Oh, ratings-wise, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, brought people back again and said, I want to see NASCAR on television every weekend from now on, because if this is the way they're going to race and this is the way it's going to be, I need to see that.
Now, I'll paraphrase a cousin of mine. I'm not going to identify him or her,
okay,
but him. I'll paraphrase and keep him anonymous so I don't embarrass him. But he likes to point out that one of his favorite things about, as he calls it, the old races is that you never know what's going to happen.
Okay.
And I think this is a prime example. Now, we should say that on turn three, this is a sort of cursory description of how it happens. I think Donnie's in the lead, right?
Yes, that's right. Donnie
is in front of Cale. Mm-hmm. And so Cale is edging up to make a pass attempt.
On the backstretch, yeah.
On the backstretch.
Mm-hmm.
And as the regulations, right, state now, at least, there's a minimum amount of space that the person being passed must grant the person attempting to pass.
If there's an attempted pass, you need to grant at least one car width, I believe, between that and the inside line, which would be the white line on the track, not necessarily the grass or mud, mm-hmm. which was in this case, it was mud in the infield of Daytona, which it's kind of hard to imagine now, but it was that way.
So Cale is making the attempt, and Donnie Allison is, I guess, asserting his position.
Let's just say it, Ben. He was blocking.
He was blocking.
And it happens. This is closed wheel racing or covered wheel racing, mm-hmm. in that it's not open wheel like in an IndyCar. So there is a bit of bumping that happens. And, you know, it doesn't have the disastrous consequences like open wheel does, where they launch
each other, right? Yeah.
So there's bumping. And let me tell you, that bumping, that's severe. I mean, when you watch that, can you believe that they were even able to keep the car straight after that?
As long as they did?
Amazing.
Yeah, they are. It's like an action movie car chase, because they're grinding their cars at each other at one point.
And just skidding off of each other several times. I mean, they make contact two or three times. I'd say three times.
Yeah.
One car, Cale's car, just noses right into Donnie's car. They both ride up the track and into the wall in turn three.
Yep.
And as you can imagine, that puts them both out. They both slide back down the track, and, you know, they end up in the infield, mm-hmm. in turn three. Meanwhile, guess who passes them?
Richard Petty.
Yeah, that's right.
Passes.
Yeah, Richard Petty. And what's kind of interesting about this is Petty almost doesn't win the race. If you watch the rest of the clip, you'll find that Darrell Waltrip almost passes Richard Petty just before the finish line, but, you know, he gets the victory, mm-hmm. narrowly. And just at that moment, that's right when, you know, the checkered flag's flying, you know, there's all this excitement, and, you know, there's like, I can't believe what a great race this has been, you know, and the wreck happened, and, you know, that they think that's it. And then suddenly, you know, one of the announcers picks up with, it appears we may have a fist fight.
Let's just play the clip.
It appears we may have a fist fight. We see drivers and helmets, safety officials trying to jump in there and separate them as tempers have really flared after this amazing incident on the final lap coming into turn number three.
As you could tell by that description there, the guys are still wearing their helmets for a minute, and they are wailing on each other.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the Allison brothers,
Donnie and Bobby.
Donnie and Bobby. Yeah, they had had a little, I guess, altercation with Cale earlier in the day, I suppose. Now, I don't know which one it was. I don't know if it was, Donnie or if it was Bobby who spun out early in the day with Cale. I'm not sure about that. I think the tension was building. I want to say it was Donnie. But at the end of the race, now what happened, how Bobby got involved in this fist fight at the end was that he pulled up into turn three to pick up his brother after the race, just to say, do you need to ride back to the pits? and somehow, you know, he hears Cale yelling at him, you know, and he gets involved in this, or he's tried not to get involved, according to him.
Right.
And just kind of got wrapped up in the whole thing.
And here's something that some race fans might enjoy. If you haven't checked out the story of the infamous 1979 Daytona 500 fight, you can see both Cale Yarbrough and Donnie Allison much later in life, and they still disagree on who was at fault.
Yeah, I don't know when that clip is from, but there's still, you can tell there's still some
animosity.
There's a bit of anger there,
yeah.
And you know what, Ben, I need to say this too before we wrap up this one, because we've got another one coming up, an F1 story we're coming up to. Mm-hmm. Donnie Allison, he claims that Cale ran into the back of his car and that he wasn't trying to run him off the track or any of that stuff, right?
Right.
Now, there was a NASCAR appeal, apparently, but I found out that Allison and Yarbrough were both fined $80,000 and put on probation after
wow.
that. Now, I mean, that was a big deal to them, you know, NASCAR, because they didn't want that, you know, to tarnish their reputation. They thought, oh, my God, what a mistake.
Right,
you know,
NASCAR carefully manages its public reputation.
Well, even in 1979, NASCAR was thinking, oh, no, we're on television, and here's our guys. They're acting like, you know, a couple of fools out in the
right.
track, you know,
they're
fighting.
They're wrestling.
But what NASCAR didn't realize was that's what people wanted. They loved that. They were so excited to see that happen. So, anyways, it's an interesting footnote, I guess, is that, you know, this huge fine, $80,000 in 1979. Can you imagine how big that was? It's a lot of money.
Wow.
Yeah. So, all right.
Even for racing, you know, it reminds me a little bit of the Jocko Flacco story because, of course, racing authorities don't want somebody to do something crazy like get into a fist fight or mm-hmm. hop in the car with a monkey mascot.
Mm-hmm.
But when they did, it turns out that the public really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it could go one of two ways, and it happened to sway in their favor.
Right. And, of course, we are not in any way suggesting this fight was staged. This is clearly an instance where two very competitive people have a differing view of the opinion of the events, you know.
Oh, sure. One of two sides. That's right.
Right. And
so, pick your side. So it's the 2001 Spanish Grand Prix,
mm-hmm.
and it's in Barcelona, Spain. Now, Mika Hakkinen, at the time, if you remember, he was a really good F1
yeah.
driver. And now at that point in 2001, I don't know if he wasn't really at his peak, because I think it was like 98, 99 when he was really winning a lot of races.
And he had three successive wins before this
yeah.
at this track.
And, you know, outright before that, in 98, 99, he had like the driver's championship. So he was, you know, he's consistently winning races a lot. And you mentioned, you know, the three wins. He had won in 98, 99, 2000, and here we are in 2001. And we're talking at this same event. Now, he had won the Spanish Grand Prix three times in a row. This is going to be number four for him. So it's a big deal, right?
And until the final lap, everybody thought it was going to be the fourth win.
Yeah, I mean, he had led, now get this, he'd only led like 26 out of the 65 laps that were run that day, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, that, again, would have been his fourth win. All he had to do, he was in the lead on the last lap.
Oh, yeah. You have one job at this point, sir.
Yeah, and this happens often. All he had to do was hang on to his lead. And you would think this would be super simple because the second place driver, who happened to be Michael Schumacher in his Ferrari,
mm-hmm.
was way behind because he had a mechanical failure. He had some kind of a vibration happening.
Right.
That
yeah.
kept him running at a slower pace, kept him off the main lap even, for some amount of time. And and then even farther beyond that was Juan Montoya, who was in a Williams BMW, and he was even farther back. So Mika's way, way out in front. All he's got to do is just drive one lap flawlessly, right?
Just one final lap, nothing, no problems,
yeah.
right? No big problems.
But Now, as he starts his fourth lap, just as he starts the fourth lap a few seconds into it, now he himself made no mistakes. Let's just put that out there.
That's a really good point. This was not his fault.
This really wasn't his fault. This is a mechanical failure. But almost right away, one of the announcers says, I hear his car rattling or something like that. I heard it rattle on that pass. And then suddenly there's smoke billowing out of the back of Mika's car.
And his engine is gone.
Yeah, his engine, you thought it was an engine. Turns out it was his clutch. He had a hydraulic failure that blew his clutch, which eventually led to other issues. And, you know, there's just, he ended up dropping out on his final lap. But the weird part is, like, before all this happened, they're saying, you know, there's all this drama and excitement because he's on his final lap, seconds into it. It's, I don't know how many miles this course is, you know, a few maybe. As he's driving and starting to slow down, that's when Michael Schumacher starts to catch up from behind.
At still at this reduced speed.
At reduced speed, which is exciting. See, this is where all the excitement comes.
It's the tortoise in the hair.
It's like, can he hang on to it? Can he hang on to this final lap? Does he have enough left in the engine to make it to the checkered flag? That's all he has to do is just limp across the line while Schumacher's steadily gaining at reduced speed. Mm-hmm. Now, Juan Montoya, he's so far back, it doesn't matter at this point, right?
Yeah.
But later, you know, you'll find out that, you know, not long after that, you know, Mika has to just give it up and pass. Just seconds later, literally seconds later, Schumacher passes him. And then like another 45 seconds later, Schumacher takes the victory. So we're talking like from start to finish, this all happens in like maybe 2 minutes.
Yeah, this escalates quickly.
And Schumacher, who was so far back, he thought, you know, I'm out. There's no way. You know, I'm in second place today. That's just the way it's going to be. I'm going to baby this car until I get to the finish. He ends up with the victory, and it's a big one.
And it's unforeseen. I think people will notice that's one of the primary deciding things for us when we're picking these last laps. It's the fact that you never really know who's walking away with first place.
I know it. And you know what? You want to see the way this plays out? Let's play the audio clip right now.
If he can just do this last 2.5 miles or so, he is going to have won this race 4 years in.
He's slowing down. He's slowing down, Murray. I thought I heard it rattling as it came past the pits last time. Mika Häkkinen is slowing right down. Is he out of fuel?
Oh, this could be absolutely fantastic. He's got the finish this last lap. Meantime, Michael Schumacher at reduced speed will be closing up on him. And there is Schumacher starting his last lap as Mika Häkkinen tours. Is he going to stop? Is Michael Schumacher in the last knockings of the race as Häkkinen looks down into the cockpit?
Sparks coming out of the back of him. I thought I saw a couple of sparks. Yes. So it is a pure mechanical problem for Häkkinen then. Not a shortage of fuel. Häkkinen, I do not believe, will get over the finish line.
And Adrian Newey looking down. Bang! The engine's gone. And David Coulthard had the same sort of thing happen this morning in the warm-up. It was a hydraulics problem. And on the very last lap of the Spanish Grand Prix, Michael Schumacher looks as though he's going to go through and take another win. What an incredible situation. It would be his third, and Mika Häkkinen has pulled off. Michael Schumacher has just got to get there. He goes into the lead. Wow, my goodness, an incredible finish.
All right, and so you get an idea. You get a good feel for, you know, just the excitement that builds around this, and you can hear the announcers saying, like, you know, it's just kind of the dismay in their voice, like, oh no, what's going to happen here? They're trying to figure out, like, does he have enough to make it? Can Schumacher catch up? Is he going to catch up? And then eventually you just realize that it's too much.
Now, let's go to something else. When we're talking about something unpredictable, Scott, why don't we go to the 2012...
Can I hit you with one more little thing before
this?
Because I found an interesting little note on the F1 story revolving around Mika Häkkinen, which I don't know how this evaded me for so long, but for a very brief time in 1983, Mika Häkkinen and Ayrton Senna were on the same Formula One team.
What? Really?
Yeah, they were on the same Formula One team. They were on the McLaren team. It was just a matter of a couple of races, really. And Mika, as it turns out, was a backup driver for Senna at some point during that time. And I think that what happened was it was only for two races at the end of the season when they were both on the same team or racing as on the same team, because at the end of the Italian Grand Prix, Michael Andretti, who was the other Formula One driver, Michael Andretti tried Formula One for 1 year and didn't do very well at all. He retired in 7 out of 13 races. So, for various mechanical problems, crashes, whatever it happened to be. But he was dismissed, as they say, after the Italian Grand Prix. And that's when Mika picked up the slack for him. And so Mika Hakkinen and Ayrton Senna were driving on the same team for two races before Ayrton left to go to the Williams team in 84. So, 94. So that was a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of cool to have two people that were clearly, I mean, they ended up being top of their,
top of the field. Yeah. But that's strange because historically it's fascinating because you don't really, I don't really think of the legendary names as people who hang out and meet each other. You know what I mean?
Yeah, usually they're on separate teams. Usually.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Typically they're competitors that are, against one another. They're not, necessarily sharing garage space. And,
maybe that's why.
Hakkinen was around for the full 83 season, I believe, but he was just a backup driver at that point. He wasn't the main one of the main drivers. So, just an interesting footnote, historical footnote that I thought people should notice because I may have said 83 back in there. I meant 93, obviously. The 93 season.
Yeah.
Okay.
You corrected.
Right. Okay, good.
So, wait, I hate to interrupt.
What's that?
All right, man. I got some bad news. This was supposed to be our easy podcast this week.
It is easy.
Well, yeah, it is easy, but that's the problem. We're having too much fun. This was also supposed to be our short podcast.
Oh, I see the point here. So we're running a little bit long. So maybe, we can break this up into two parts. How about that?
You know what? Agreed. Because just for our listeners, just so you guys know, every time that we tell ourselves we're going to have a short podcast, we jinx ourselves. And it looks like it happened again. So we're going to go ahead and make this a two-parter. Tune in to hear the second part of our series on famous last laps. In the meanwhile, drop us a line on Facebook, give us a holler at Twitter, or send us an email at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.